Good afternoon. How is everyone? Nobody got lost finding the place or anything other than us, but we made it. It's a pleasure to be here today. This is my first presentation at a SSSA joint conference. Normally, you can tell from the title, I'm at fluvial geomorph conferences and things of that nature. But we've been doing some work with some interesting overlap, and we wanted to come and share it with soil scientists and others, and get some idea of your thinking about the topics that we were addressing. You can see from the title, we're going to talk about managing mobile rivers and agricultural lands. Sort of an interesting series and string of words there. We mean the managing when we think about it. This is some work I'm doing with my colleagues Broxton Bird and Pierre-André Jacinthe. And we are collectively Center for Earth and Environmental Science and Department of Earth Sciences. To confuse everybody, we also work under the banner of the Silver Jackets, which in Indiana are all these different acronyms up here. Silver Jackets are an interagency hazard mitigation team that's designed to kind of leverage resources for problems that fall outside of the direct purview of any of the agencies, and also to take on tasks that none of them want to do by themselves. And this is going to be one of those. In June 2008, we had a series of devastating floods in Indiana. It damaged lots of bridges, lots of roads, lots of culverts, millions of dollars worth of damage. But the other thing that it did is it damaged a lot of agricultural land, particularly in the floodplains, as you can imagine. But the damage was significant, and it caused an outcry from the agricultural community about what are you going to do about this? There's some philosophical questions here, hence the manage in the term and the title when I first came up here. A floodplain is a floodplain. Don't mean to be circular there, but it should flood. And floodplains can damage, and we don't really want to try to protect you against a natural phenomenon. That's not the goal. But their next question was interesting. Well, this seemed to be unusual. This seemed to kind of fall outside of the range of what could be considered normal. Now, in Indiana, this is a problem in and of itself. Indiana is oriented long direction north to south. So there's a fairly interesting latitudinal variation in our rivers to begin with. We can have very active rivers in the central part of the state. This is the Flat Rock River near Columbus, Indiana. You can take a look at this river and know that it moves a lot. This is a false color ramped LIDAR image, but you can see the pattern. This is the Tippecanoe River here, a northern river. And you can see from its plan form that that thing is set like it has been. That platform was set when the ice retreated north, and it hasn't moved or shifted since. Now, if you're farming in this floodplain, you're in trouble. If you're farming in this floodplain here, you don't even notice it. This one's really curious for those of you that remember your first fluvial geomorph class or geomorph class. In the Tippy, you have people living on the point bars. You have cabins on the point bars. Pretty interesting thing. It's a depositional environment. On the Flat Rock, you last about 6 months, and you're gone. So right off the bat, we've got different rivers behaving in different fashion. How different? We looked at 970 meander bins. We wore out several sets of eyes on different people on Google Earth measuring migration patterns. 970 different meanders to understand what was the average rate of movement on Indiana rivers. I lost a beer on this. I thought our rivers moved a lot. People don't call fluvial geomorphologists to come and see rivers that are just flowing. So we get a kind of a skewed perspective. They call us for rivers that are causing them problems. They're doing something they don't want them to happen. So I get called for ones that are acting up. Turns out most of them aren't. You can see here that we've got a large number of them that are scarcely moving, and just a few at this end that are moving a lot. Most of the rivers in Indiana moving less than a foot a year, some of them moving as much as 35, 40 feet a year. When we map out the spatial variation in those rivers or distribution, It's equally interesting. So here, what we've done is we've showed you 48 different drainage basins. 16 of those drainage basins are highlighted in dark blue. The dark blue are what we call actively migrating channels. They're moving at rates of over a foot a year, and in some cases, 35, 40 feet a year. The pattern is interesting. Most of them seem to be oriented on sort of a northeast to southwest trend, suggesting that something about the glacial outwash valleys, maybe the sediment type, maybe the width of them, may be exacerbating the problem, causing these things to migrate a little bit more. Others are scarcely moving at all. This is an example of the kind of thing we're looking at. This is White River near Centerton, Indiana. This image, this river here has a drainage area upstream about 244 square miles, or about 6,300 square kilometers. It has a predicted meander belt width, and you can see it there, of about 1,900 feet. Its meander belt width is twice what we would predict for a river of that size. The bends in this area are anomalous even on this river, which begs the question of why. Why are most of the rivers in Indiana not moving this much, and why are some of them moving so much? Make sense? So if most of them aren't moving hardly at all, why are some moving so much? Is it something we've done? Is it some type of change in climate? What could it be? You can see here that it's now adopted a much more normal migration pattern. So you can see here a very extreme meander bend. And here you can see that it's cut it off. And now its form, planform, form is much more like what we would expect. So it's adjusting, it's changing. Can't help but wonder if this doesn't tell part of the story. This is observed change in very heavy precipitation. You see the graph there. Most of you have probably seen this for the Midwest. You can see in the last few years a fairly significant change in precipitation, particularly heavy precipitation. A lot of variability. We either get a lot of rain or we don't get much. So that extreme variability is something that was predicted in the climate change models. It's something we think we're already seeing, but you can see a couple of interesting features here. Notice, I think, the dramatic uptick starting in the late 80s and into the early 90s. You don't see a nice smooth transition. This thing's going tick, 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 boom. If you know anything about when infrastructure was built in this country, you know most of it was built back here. It's back in the drier period. So right off the bat, you've got restrictions and constraints on our rivers from culverts, bridges, roads, that are now being threatened by these rivers that are responding a little bit differently than they might have done before. So the question, how much differently are they responding? This is data from the USGS Gauge at Centerton, Indiana. You can see a 10-year moving average plotted across there. The linear trend is striking. It's straight up. Even the moving average is a little bit scary. I put something else on here that sometimes I'll take off just because it skews things so much. You'll see the flood of 1913. And you can see the size and the scale of that relative to the other peak events. Out of the realm of anything we've ever seen. Twice the size of most of our highest peaks. So, is it this uptick in events? Notice, I talked about the variability. Notice that we still have droughts. Notice the trend here is just back and forth. So, these channels are now adjusting to a much heavier range of flows. More variability, more different flood pulses. From a geomorph perspective, it's sort of interesting to think about the fact that this experienced a discharge of about 90,000 cubic feet per second back in 1913. Okay, now, a little over 100 years ago, is this river still adjusting to that? Potentially. It's not out of the realm of reason to think that it would take 2,500 square mile watershed that long to change and adjust. It doesn't. Not with the other changes that are going on in the landscape. So, potentially. Is it a climate signature? Potentially. Is there anything else that could cause problems? We know that it's been changing fairly fast. These images are taken in 2005 and 2015. And you can see that in 2005, that extreme meander hadn't been cut off. And so it cut it off fairly quickly, and that will happen. So, but we're still rapidly shifting and adjusting and moving around. We also have these things. I changed the image picture on you a little bit, but you can still see the big meander. What you see in this sort of lavender color here is a zone that we call the active erosion zone. So a zone where we see that that river has been recently, and that goes into the management piece that we're going to talk to you about here a little bit. But each of these red lines, I'm either going to shoot the head of the moderator with this laser, or I'm going to not get the thing on here. But so, no, you don't have to sit back. I won't hit you. Each of these red lines indicates what we call, has an interesting term, non-levee embankments. See, if something's a levee, then there are regulations and rules and restrictions. These are things that have been built that sort of look like levees and serve like levees, but don't have the engineering behind them that levees do. So they don't come with the liability set, but they do influence the river substantially. So when we start looking at the distribution of these and where we see lots of movement, this can be pretty interesting in that we almost always find these non-levee structures near an area where we're seeing movement that it could be a little bit questionable. And you can see from this figure, there's a lot of them there as well. So, discharge has gone up. Discharge has gone up. Rain precipitation patterns have changed. We have non-levee embankments that are directing flows in areas that we don't want them to move in. And we have farmers that are upset and want us to fix the river. We don't want to fix the river because we don't really necessarily think it's broken, but we want to be able to explain these sort of anomalous movements. We think about 90% of it's explained by climate, by the variability that you're seeing in precipitation, because when we take them all away, land use from this basin we can take out and move around, it doesn't seem to be causing the problem. But that variability, this increase in 2-inch or greater rains, seems to be affecting our rivers across the state. We see incision, we see more movement, we see a range of things like that. Which begs the question, how do you manage a river? And how do you manage river in agricultural areas? If you have a climate signature changing, if you still have people near it, and what we've tried to do is say, you know, in this area, in this area, you can see sort of outlined turquoise and then lavender color there. The best way to manage this is stay away from it. Stay back away from it. Because it is going to continue to move in these areas. We think there are some other drivers. We think there are some other problems. But for right now, there's too much variation in the potential problems to not just tell you to avoid it. We have some other hopes and goals. We are concerned about how quickly these soils in this area and how these sediments might behave. We have an interesting problem with these agricultural lands. If a stream migrates into infrastructure, we can often rebuild it. We can't rebuild the soils. And it does remove them. It's not like it shifts from one place to another. It does move them. You can read a lot more about the things that we're trying to do on our obligatory program website. Just type in FEH in Indiana, and you'll see some links to me show up and the other work we're doing. And I have to thank the Silver Jackets for this. It's a task that no one group wanted to take on, but I think is going to prove valuable in the end. When you come to value added and questions in Indiana, our $15,000 an acre farm ground raises attention pretty quick. And we're losing it at several thousand acres a year. Office of Community and Rural Affairs paid for all of this, and we appreciate their continued support. Thank you.